Okay, welcome to our second installment, our second class of the Advanced Fellowship Parsha class, and we're going to do Parshas Noach to get us in the framework. Our goal is to, at the very least, at this week's Shabbos table, if you're called upon to give a Dvar Torah, you'll be fully prepared. You'll have actually not one, but a couple of Divrei Torah to share. At the end of the class, I'll give sort of a synopsis, so you can have a couple of nuggets to take away. Okay, so we're going to do with, the title is seemingly disconnected, but as you will soon see, exactly is a main issue, a main theme in the story of Noah and the Flood. So, the title is of the class is called Justice, Only Justice You Shall Seek. And is justice really a priority in Orthodox life? So before I start, I'm going to ask you guys, would you say in your experience, in your journeys, is justice really a priority in Orthodox life? What do you guys say?
This is Stacy. I would say yes, but we don't always know what justice is. A lot of times we say it's not going to come in this world, it's going to come in next. So that, you know, has always been actually something I kind of struggle with when I think about, but I think that we say justice, you know, will come. We're talking about, we just don't know when that will be. It's up to Hashem.
Right. So you're dealing with the bigger topic of justice, you know, God's justice. Now, like, for example, why do bad things happen to good people? Or conversely, why do good things happen to bad people? I'm talking about justice within the Jewish community, between what they call Bein Adam L'Chaveru, amongst each other and amongst others. Is that a priority?
So I would say yes. I mean, I think, like we also say, you know, doing good between man and man is more important even than God. So when I think of justice, I think of doing what's right and being, you know, accepting of what's right and getting what you deserve. And so I would say from that perspective, yes. But I have a feeling you're going to say no.
Okay. So, I mean, look, I don't want, again, it's obviously, in a certain sense, not easy for us to judge. So what I want to do is I'm going to start off with a video. This happened not that long ago. Those who, you can see the video, I'll be showing it. This is of the president of Israel, Moshe Katsav, who, when he got convicted of rape. Here we go. Let's go to the videotape. Here we go.
He's become the highest-ranking Israeli official ordered to serve time in prison. Former President Moshe Katsav was in court Tuesday to hear the sentence handed down to him following his conviction in December for raping a former employee and sexually harassing two other women. He remained stoic throughout most of the session as his lawyers pleaded for leniency, but he refused to sit in the dock until the cameras left the courtroom. And when a judge on the panel of three read the prepared verdict sentencing Katsav to 7 years in prison, he screamed, "You made a mistake. It's a lie." His sons had been in attendance, and on exiting the courtroom, Katsav shouted at security guards who scuffled with them. Otherwise, he appeared impassive. On the way out, as on the way in, Katsav himself made no comment to waiting media, although he appeared worried and distraught. Outside the building, a group of women held signs telling female victims of sex crimes, "You're not alone." The case has been seen as a victory for women's rights in a long struggle to chip away at Israel's macho culture. Miriam Schler runs a rape crisis center in Tel Aviv.
But even somebody who's in a position of extreme power, like the president of Israel, cannot exploit his position of power and cannot abuse women. As far as we're concerned, it's a very, very important day for all victims of sexual assault and for the legal system here in Israel.
Katsev has claimed he's been a victim of a political witch hunt, and his lawyers have argued their client did not receive a fair trial because of a hostile climate created by media reporting of his case. Attorney Zion Amir.
For 4.5 years, the law enforcement system has brutally ignored the law and trampled on the rights of the defendant. The result is that we will now focus on filing the appeal to the Supreme Court. That's what we'll do.
The 65-year-old Katsav has time to appeal. He doesn't have to report to prison until May 8th. Karen Sloan, The Associated Press.
Okay. All right, so... So that was a major... That was a major, major blow. You know, you don't have presidents of states going to jail, which he actually is in jail currently, for rape and for abusing his position of power. And I just want to read, if you guys, could somebody see the little first paragraph there? Little box, could somebody see that? I want to read that. Guys?
That's number one?
Yeah.
Section?
Yeah. The first box.
Yeah.
Yeah, if you can read it, Kat, that'd be great.
Oh, okay. Katsav is Israel Prison Service inmate number 1418989. His cell is located in the prison's Tarani cell block, a special block for religious prisoners. Though considered less harsh than other blocks, inmates in the Tarani block have no access to television or newspapers. Prisoners are woken at 4:30 a.m. for morning prayers, pray 3 times a day, and spend most of the day in 2 seminaries studying Torah and other sacred Jewish texts.
All right, so Moshe Katsav is an Orthodox Jew, and he's in prison now for a number of years. And he's basically in sort of a enforced yeshiva. Not enforced, but, basically it's like it's a yeshiva you can't leave. So he's there, they dab, they have minyanim, they have two yeshiva out there, and they learn. Now, it's not just Orthodox people in Israel. I'm just giving you, I got this from Wikipedia. You guys can see over here, the list of Israeli public officials convicted of crimes. It's going to go, we have the president, Moshe Katsav, for rape, obstruction of justice, 7 years in prison. Then we had the prime minister, Ehud Olmert, non-Orthodox. He was sentenced to 6 years in prison for a breach of trust and bribery. Then we have ministers, like there's a cabinet in Israel, you have, after the prime minister has the cabinet, you have Aaron Abuchatzera, Orthodox. Shlomo Ben Isri, Haredi. Ari Deri, Haredi. Tzachi Negbi, I'm not sure where he was. Aaron Hershenson, some are Orthodox, some are traditional, some are secular. Avigdor Lieberman, secular. Yitzchak Mordechai, I think it's, whatever, you keep on going. Knesset members, the list goes on and on and on. Public officials, the president of the mayor of Jerusalem, convicted of corruption in May of 2014. Then we have rabbis. The chief rabbi, the former chief Ashkenazic rabbi, there's not been a conviction, but he's arrested and under house arrest until they go through the whole trial, but basically under charged with bribery, money laundering, and income tax violations. There's a famous Kabbalistic rabbi, Rabbi Yosef Pinto, who also was sentenced a year in prison and asked to pay 1 million shekels. So, both Orthodox, traditional, and non-Orthodox Jews, when the Jews are given power, such as in the State of Israel, what do you see? How would you describe that scenario?
There's a care for justice, regardless of who someone is. There's still a belief that justice is the most important thing, regardless of who is the one committing an act.
Right. So first of all, on one hand, you can see, at least the State of Israel, there is, despite the numerous public officials, from the president, the prime minister, to the cabinet, to the thing. It's not a complete corrupt banana republic where basically you can pay yourself off and not have to, you know, go to court. Here, if you are caught, if there is an investigation, an indictment, and a trial and a conviction, you're gonna, no matter who you are, you're going to go to jail. Which, by the way, I would agree with Jen. That's a very good thing. But that's the good side. What's the bad side? What were you hoping to find? Were you hoping to find a dedicated Wikipedia page listing Israeli public officials convicted of crimes and misdemeanors?
No, you're hoping that they're very strict and there's no one, or that there's one person total. You're hoping that they're very strict, but at the same time, there's no one to be strict towards.
Right, or you'd hope that if Judaism is about, part of Judaism is about stucco mishpat, being righteous and doing justice, that you're not going to see, you know, a pretty persistent, these are the convictions, there are many investigations going on, a persistent climate and culture where people are trying to use their power, take advantage of others, and basically enrich themselves and their families. You know what I'm saying? You'd want to see that. And you want to not see about, you know, thievery and bribery and all this kind of stuff. Okay? And, you know, not only that, there's, unfortunately, even in America, we had, you know, Rabbi Freundel, you know, used his position and, you know, was involved in, you know, were convicted of 40 to 52 counts of voyeurism with the women of his community and, you know, with the mikvah. You have other rabbis, both in Israel and America, that were, you know, had to step down due to, you know, either sexual things, which is a kind of abuse of power. And so I would like to argue that while justice may be a priority in Orthodox life, it's not the priority it needs to be, because this is, on any report card, I don't think the Jewish people are getting an A over here. You know what I'm saying? Now, a regular person, you would think, you know, well, maybe it's just issue of people who are in power. Obviously, you know, only if you have influence can you peddle that influence. You know what I'm saying? So it doesn't apply to everybody. So let's take this back, why I brought this into the Parsha. Let's start with the first couple psukim of the Parsha. Who would like to read? The second paragraph.
I'll read.
Dead, Stacy.
These are the chronicles of Noah. Noah was a righteous man, perfect in his generation. Noah walked with God. Noah fathered three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. The world was corrupt before God, and the land was filled with chametz, bribery. God saw the world, and it was corrupted. All flesh had perverted its way on the earth. God said to Noah, "The end of all flesh has come before me. The world is filled with man's chametz."
Well, not Hamas.
Hamas.
Right, Hamas, right.
Hamas, bribery. I will therefore destroy them with the earth.
Okay. So the Parsha opens up with the main character being, of course, Noah, and he's described as a righteous guy, and he has three children. And then how does the Torah describe the world? It has two terms.
Corrupt.
That's number one, and then number two is Hamas, which is when we're looking to Rashi, is translated as robbery or thievery. Let's take a look at Rashi over here. Okay, so it says Vatisha Ches Aretz, the land was corrupt. Stacy, keep on going. You're doing a great job.
Where do you want me to read?
Paragraph, box number three.
I can't see what the Hebrew says.
No, just read the Hebrew, just read the English.
Okay. Was corrupt is an expression of immorality and idolatry. Other editions add, immorality, for all flesh had corrupted its way, and idolatry, lest you deal corruptly.
All right, so Rashi says, based upon this Gemara here in Sanhedrin, that the word tishaches, which means corrupted, indicates not just they're, you know, not great, but they're doing what they call the cardinal sins. What are their three cardinal sins in Judaism? What are the three cardinal sins? What are the three?
Sexual immorality, is that one?
That's one.
Idolatry.
That's number two.
Someone else has to tell me what three. I'm afraid.
Number three. What's the third one? What?
Murder.
Murder is correct. And these are things that if somebody puts a gun to your head and says, I want you to commit either one of these three things, you have to take the bullet. You cannot. Judaism has defined that life is not worth living if you have to do this cardinal sin. Okay? So, this was obviously extremely bad, corrupt generation. Okay? This says God saw the world, it was corrupted. Obviously, only God can make this assessment. We're not in a position to assess the metaphysical worth of an individual, much less a community, and much less an entire society, and much less the entire civilization, but God can make that assessment. Then it says, all flesh had perverted its ways on earth. God said to Noah, the end of all flesh has come before her. The world is filled with man's chamas, robbery. Check out the last thing which is mentioned here is that is chamas, which means that what was the deciding blow that God communicated that I'm now going to destroy them from the earth? What was that quality, characteristic that, wrote their death sentence?
Can you say that again?
What was the crime that God decided to destroy the world for with a flood? What was the main quality? What was the crime that they were involved in that demanded their destruction? So as Rashi points, it says, "Timaleiros are Hamas." The last thing is Hamas. I didn't put down the Rashi. The Gezar Dinam was. Their decree was based upon their involvement in robbery and theft. Okay? Dishonest gain. Now, so apparently, when they were in an earlier time, when they're involved in just idolatry and sexual immorality, God could tolerate that. So why is God deciding to kill them when they're involved in theft? Because I'll ask you a simple question. If a person puts a gun to your head and says, I want you to go into that store and steal a candy bar, or I'll kill you, what do you do?
You steal the candy bar?
You steal the candy bar. So from that perspective, it seems that idolatry and immorality is far worse than theft, yet, as Rashi picks up, that the deciding factor was the Gezar Dinam, the decree, was only based upon gezel, theft, robbery. That was the decree. So my question to you guys is, I'd like to hear from you, is why is, if idolatry is worse, why would God only decide to destroy the world based on robbery? What do you guys got to say?
Okay, I'll just say, because idolatry is again between man and God, where robbery is hatred towards each other and different people and doing bad to each other. It's like the concept of the baseless hatred, which later was the cause of destruction also.
Okay,
right?
So that's true. It's what they call Beit Adam Lechavero. But why is that? But why is it worse? You see that halachically it's not worse. In other words, a person says, if I'm going to do a sin, am I going to do idolatry or am I going to do robbery? It's definitely less worse to do robbery. But when it comes to God's judgment of the world, His deciding to destroy the world occurs via the robbery, which is on the surface is less bad. What do you guys got to say? Anybody else?
I remember reading, and I forget where this is from, but that it wasn't robbery, they weren't stealing food to feed their children. They were stealing things just for themselves. It was I'm the center of the worldness that was just so against the world working right. I deserve things that don't belong to me. It had nothing to do with other people in a positive way. It was just, I'm in the center of the world, I should get whatever I want.
Now, why is that worse than, adultery or incest? Or idolatry? I mean, that's bad, but it seems to be, what is that quality that makes it intolerable in the eyes of God? What you're saying is correct. I'm just trying to push you to develop a little further here.
Oh, for one thing, each of those are against one other person, but by stealing and using that, you're saying there's no God. You know, I'm more important than God. I'm more important than other people. I'm more important, I'm the center of the world. It's not just, idolatry is just saying that God's not important, and immorality is, morality is not important, or man's not important. Adultery is, that person's husband's not important, or that person's wife is not important. But robbery is saying no one else is important. I'm the only one in the world.
So
you're becoming God.
Okay, from the measurement of metric of halakha, if you weigh each individual crime on an individual basis, Vodah Zarah, idolatry, or Gilui Arayah, sexual morality, is defined as far worse. It has a death penalty. There is no death penalty for robbery. You just have to return the object. So, but you're onto something. I mean, there's a step here. All right, so I'll just, being we started a little late, I'll just jump in and give share an answer. This is an answer I heard from my teacher, Rabbi Chait, a long time ago. In other words, it is true that on an individual basis, it's a greater distortion, it's a greater evil for Avodah Zarah. Is the whole mission of Judaism is to bring forth to the world the idea of the one true God, and to remove the fantasy of other forces ruling the world. That's one factor. And sexual morality is a problem of people engaged in sexuality, immersing them in sexuality to the extent of everything else. That's not that becomes that physical pleasure becomes the absolute good, and that's also all wrong, and therefore has to be boundaries. But insofar as the social fabric, in other words, once you have rampant robbery going on, the entire structure of the social order comes down, and there could be no growth or development. So really, when humanity was involved in sexual morality, God tolerated that. When they were involved in addition, idolatry, God was tolerant of that, because they were still functioning as a coherent society. They were still able to have a structure of society which could then be built off. Once you have rampant theft and robbery, and basically every man out for themselves, you know, there can be no, the social structures start to fall apart, and there can't be really any human development at that point. Society, basically, the connective tissues of society start to fall apart, and therefore, any possibility of turning the boat around and developing out of this low state is perished. At that point, once that happened, once there was no structure of society, then there was no possibility. Whoever's on, just put your mute on. A lot of feedback there. So that's the main idea. In reality, on the individual base level, idolatry and immorality is worse. Whoever just got on, can you put yourself on mute because there's a lot of feedback? Thank you. It's as far as the framework of the entire society as a whole. If there is rampant robbery and thievery, the entire social structure falls apart. There cannot be a stability and a basic measure of justice where it can then be humanity can grow out of that, and therefore their fate, if you will, is then sealed, and there could be no development at that point. So, for example, Pirkei Avos says, I didn't put it down as a source, it says, you should pray for the government, even the non-Jewish government, because without that, each person would swallow his neighbor, says Pirkei Avos. What does that mean? That in the eyes of Judaism, even a corrupt government, which creates a basic measure of social order, is still a social good, and is better than anarchy. Anarchy is the worst, and will not allow any development, especially when you have a society which is steeped in sexual immorality and idolatry. Once the theft goes basically at that point, the only thing that God could do would be to, A, rescue the good people, Noah and his family, and press the reset button on the rest of humanity. Okay, so is that, before I go on to the next concept, is that clear? A little feedback here. Nobody's showing their video, so I can't tell if that's a clear concept or not. But please tell me if that makes sense or any questions.
Makes sense.
Okay, good. All right, so let's go on to our next. So that's concept number one. We're building on that. That, by the way, is an individual Dvar Torah. You want to share that, and you can ask that question to your Shabbos table. Next question. We're going to hit another Rashi. Who would like to read? And Noach walked with God. Classic Rashi. Who would like to read it? Brother Stacy, you're on again.
Okay. Noah walked with God, but concerning Abraham, Scripture says, "The Lord before whom I walked." Noah required God's support to uphold him in righteousness, but Abraham strengthened himself and walked in his righteousness by himself.
Yes. Okay, so this is, by the way, a rather unusual kind of midrash, because in Judaism, we don't really believe in comparing people. You know what I'm saying? Each person's their own person. You know what I'm saying? Where they're given strength and they're given weaknesses. You will not find a Rashi which brings down a Midrash that compares the relative excellence of, let's say, Moshe versus Aaron versus Miriam. You know what I'm saying? Or David versus his son Shlomo. You know what I'm saying? You're not going to find that. This is an unusual phenomenon. The Rashi here is bringing down from the Tanhuma, which is an ancient source of Midrashim, that says, they pick up, it says, Et Elohim mitalech Noach, that Noach walked with God, but by later on, talks about Avram, that Asher Yitzalach Lefanav, that he walked before him. So basically, that Avram was more autonomous. Okay. The next question is, well, all right, so Avram's better. Why do we care? Why is that relevant? And third of all is, why was that the case? Any thoughts about that? Why are we comparing Avram to Noah, or Noah to Avram? Any thoughts on the matter?
One difference is that Abraham wanted to save other people. Abraham really worked hard to give as much as he could to others. Noah was righteous in terms of himself, and maybe his family, I'm not sure.
Right.
But, you know, he got drunk after the flood because he didn't do enough to try to convince other people. You know, people asked, why are you building an ark? Because God's going to... But he didn't specifically try to convince people to do tshuva or to join him or to, to improve. Whereas Abraham's whole mission was to, one, to help people, regardless of whether or not they moved them closer to God, and two, to make people, understand about one God and bring them close.
100%. So that one of the things that is striking, and in fact, it's referenced in the Haftarah. They call the Haftarah refers to it's from Isaiah, where it calls it the May Noach, the flood waters of Noach. Now, on one level, it could just say it's a flood that occurred in the time of Noach. But the rabbis see a little deeper, a little bit of a slight indictment. It's a flood waters that came because of Noach. That Noach, due to, his lack, was unable to try to go out and impact others. Which gets into the point of, why are they being compared? Because Noah was really a potential father of civilization. And unfortunately, he failed. He was able to, now we don't want to minimize his perfection. He's still called a tzaddik. Now, all of us would love to be called a tzaddik by Hashem. But his capacity, whether it was a lack of his conviction, whether he had other doubts that were gnawing at him that made him ambivalent and therefore he could not effectively deal with it, or he didn't have the skill set to deal with such a difficult crowd, a difficult society, okay? But the bottom line is, and as Jen also alluded to, later in the Parsha, you'll see that after he gets out of the ark, he does an offering to Hashem, and God, feels that's a great thing. And then he plants a vineyard, and in that vineyard, he drinks and gets drunk. What is the idea of getting drunk? Why is he getting drunk? Any thoughts on that? We've all seen people getting drunk, and there are different reasons that people get drunk. Why would Noah want to be drunk? Any thoughts? Why would Noah want to get drunk after the entire Mabul flood experience?
I would just say, people get drunk to forget experiences. So, building an ark, experiencing a flood, you just want to, not think about the reality of what happened.
Right. Well, so one, as people drink to forget, people drink to deny the reality. In other words, when a person had a hard day at work, the reason why you walk up and down Third Avenue, there's literally back-to-back bars, is because that's providing a very important function in society. People have a rough time. There's a thing called the happy hour. metaphorically. It really is not the happy hour. It's really the I'm depressed because I'm at work and I need to transition to, you know, restore my sense of, you know, fun of life. So I hit the old local saloon and I have a couple of beers with my friends and forget about the difficult job that I have and the difficult people I may work for. And I forget about it. So remember that Noach had, as he's being the father of civilization with his family, apparently didn't feel good about that. Felt very stressed by that job. And perhaps even missed perhaps the old society. And just could not handle it. And the crushing pressure of that responsibility, in a certain sense, drove him to drink. Now, by the way, it says that he planted a vineyard, means that he seems to have taken those grapevines with him on the ark for his year-long journey of the flood. So there was a measure of premeditation there. He just was not up to the massive challenge. Now, we don't want to minimize that he's a great man, but you can be a great man does not make you the father of society, the father of civilization. Then we come to we get to Avram. Avram is the hero. Avram's the hero. Let's take a look here. A little description here by the Rambam. All right, Stace, keep on reading.
The wise men among them would think that there is no God other than the stars and spheres for whose sake and in resemblance of which they had made these images. The eternal rock was not recognized or known by anyone in the world, with the exception of a few individuals. For example, Kanoch, Metushelah, Noah, Shem, and Ever. The world continued in this fashion until the pillar of the world, the patriarch Abraham, was born.
Okay, so here in the Rambam is talking about the history of idolatry, which is an interesting topic, but part of where during this era, basically it was a purely materialistic. People had a idolatrous vision of the world, that they felt the world was governed by the universe, basically stars and spheres, and they made certain idols to reflect these conduits of power, and basically God was completely forgotten except for a few individuals: Hanoch, Methuselah, Noach, which is part of our parsha, Shem and Aver. Until the Ram calls the pillar of the world, Avram was born. Okay, let's take a look over here. Keep on going.
After this mighty man was weaned, he began to explore and think. Though he was a child, he began to think incessantly throughout the day and night, wondering, how is it possible for the sphere, universe, to continue to revolve without having anyone controlling it? Who is causing it to revolve? Surely it does not cause itself to revolve. He had no teacher, nor was there anyone to inform him. Rather, he was mired in Ur Kasdim among the foolish idolaters. His father, mother, and all the people around him were idol worshippers, and he would worship with them. However, his heart was exploring and gaining understanding. Ultimately, he appreciated the way of truth and understood the path of righteousness through his accurate comprehension. He realized that there was one God who controlled the sphere, universe, that he created everything, and that there is no other God among all the other entities. He knew that the entire world was making a mistake. What caused them to err was their service of the stars and images, which made them lose awareness of the truth.
Okay, so Avraham Avinu, the hero, which the Ram calls the pillar of the world, Amud HaShe'olam, and a mighty man, had no teachers, had no schooling. On his own investigation, from after being weaned at age 2 and 3, till, it says later on he was 40, for 37 years, came to the conclusion that there is a God which is beyond all the cause they see in the material world. And he realized, even though that he went to the temple with his parents, he realized that they were making a mistake. And he appreciated the way of truth and understood the path of righteousness. So not only did he have an understanding about Hashem, but there's a lifestyle associated with that, which he calls the path of righteousness. So I have a couple questions for you guys. What lifestyle emerges from Avram's newfound understanding of the existence of God? So I'm just telling you that in addition, in other words, in Avram's vision, to be a knower of God is by definition be a doer of righteousness. Now, why is that true? Why can, and I think earlier I'll give you guys a hint, Jennifer was alluding to that, Jen Cohen was alluding to that a little earlier. Why, if I have conviction there is a God who is the cause of the universe, why the demand upon me to act in a righteous way and do that which is give just and act in a just manner to people? A little hard question, but I'm going to throw it out to you guys. What do you guys say? Why can't I just... I maintain there is a God, but I want to be unjust and not righteous and not charitable and not compassionate. Why is that not a contradiction? Why can that exist? Why can I be a maintainer of the... There's a God who causes everything, but I'm going to be unjust. Why is that not possible? What do you guys say? It's a tough question. Everyone want to take a stab? So, the concept is, as I understand, is that if you maintain that we have God and He's created this world, so a person recognizes, well, what is my position in this world? Is the world created for me, or am I part of a humanity? And God has not given me, has given me a portion, and has given my friend a portion. And we see that the way of God is to give His creatures, as we say in benching, what they need. How God nourishes the world. So what right do I have if that's the way God relates to all individuals? Obviously, that's the appropriate way. I can't deny that I am a special. I am the purpose of. I am the totality of creation. God created the universe exclusively for me. Not the case. There are a lot of other people and creatures, and they have needs, and they have rights, and I have to do what's God created them with these needs and with these rights, and I have to I have no priority more than them, because I'm a created being just like they are. So Avram understood that once he understood his conception of God, it automatically demanded a lifestyle of righteousness, and then ultimately the next step beyond that, chesed. So it really flowed from his idea of God and God's way to the universe. Which gets into our next question. An easier question. Why does the Rambam call Avraham Avinu Amudo Shel Olam, the pillar of the world? Why is he called the pillar of the world? And as sort of a preparatory question, what really is a pillar? What does a pillar do in architecture?
So I have one thought.
Good.
I'll just say that, the pillar, I guess, is like what holds things together. And in that case, I would think that it's because Abraham has found truth, and the truth is what you know, everything is based on. And it's what it's saying in this last paragraph here is that, you know, people didn't see the truth. They lost awareness of that. So you need that. So...
100% correct. Avram Avinu is holding up, like a pillar, holds up the entire floor or building. Avram, ironically, to this very day, is holding up, his conceptions hold up the entire world with his idea of a singular God, which from that came not only just Judaism, but Christianity and Islam, so... whether they have an accurate portrayal of Avram or not, that's a separate conversation, but they recognize that Avram's conception is really holding up the world. He had the right idea, A. And B, he's giving the framework in which to how to conduct ourselves as a society. So the Avram Avinu is not just a tzaddik, he is. Not only the person with a profound insight, he is. He's a person who discovered God and the lifestyle to nurture that idea and how a society should organize itself. And Avram's impact, even though he lived 3,500 years ago, he still functions as holding up the entire Western world. Some more, some less, but his impact is truly felt today. And foundationally, insofar as Judaism, everything else, Sinai, the 613 minutes, are built upon Avram's concepts. Okay. Now I want to take it back to our topic here. So, I started off the whole class with a question. Is justice really a priority in Orthodox life? So, in one sense, you'd say, well, I mean, people do care about Beit Adam L'Chavero. People talk about it a lot. But unfortunately, you see, when Jews do have power, both, it doesn't even make a difference. Whether you're Orthodox, or you're traditional, or you're secular, when you have power, as we saw in the, you know, which is in your document, a lengthy list of convicted politicians and rabbis and people in authority who've abused that authority and acted in an unjust manner to people. So I want to ask you guys a question. If you would ask 100 people, and you ask them, well, are you a just and fair person? What do you think the answer you would get from people would be? What do you guys say? Yeah, somebody. Are you just? Are you fair? What would they say? If you asked 100 people, are you a just person? Are you a fair person? What do you think their answers would be?
Yes, most people would say yes.
Yeah, everybody's going to say, of course I am. It would be impeaching my integrity, my credibility. So the challenge here is that it's not so simple. It's a little bit, because the reality is that all people believe that they're just. As you saw from the video, when Moshe Katsav, president of Israel, was given the 7-year jail term for his engagement for raping and abusing his position of power against his subordinates, he says not true. In his own mind, he had to maintain that in reality, he's still just, and somehow or another, in his own mind, it's all a lie, it's a kangaroo court, he's been framed, and in fact, ironically, his wife put in a petition to the Supreme Court that he should be pardoned. Okay, so not only does he believe he's innocent, she believes he's innocent, and it's really all framed. So the feeling of that I am just and I am fair is intrinsic. Everybody feels they're just and fair. So that brings in a big problem. What's the problem?
I mean, the problem is then, like, there's no one standard of truth. Everyone decides what they think is just, and then it becomes just.
Right. So first of all, everybody feels they're just, but yet, in a certain sense, it becomes just for them. And people aren't, even if it's clearly, everybody understands that thievery and stealing is not just, but they, in their own mind, believe that they are acting appropriately. So it's as a midah, a quality, it is very difficult to have a measure of self-awareness about it. You know what I'm saying? You know what I mean? It's not so simple. So it's very tricky to, you know, make a, have be aware about it. I'm going to share a solution. And then my question is, are society's methods of deterring corruption effective? So we have police, we have laws, we have checks and balances to make sure not that the power does not get concentrated in one location too much. Is that effective? Is that enough? Is the various deterrents in our society and the society of Israel sufficient to maintain justice? What do you guys say? Can you, in other words, can you legislate yourself into a just and fair society? Can you add enough laws and enough police and enough judges and enough courts that you can have a just society? Is that, will that work?
You can try, but people still have free will.
Right. And when there's a, and there, when, and when there is a, you know, when people want to weasel themselves out, you know, like in America, going back to, you know, the, you know, various murder cases in America, O.J. Simpson being the most extreme case, where you got the sense that if you had enough money and you can hire the best defense lawyers, you can sort of get out of anything. You know what I'm saying? You can sort of work within the laws to try to weasel your way out of it and avoid it. I mean, a good example is that in 2008-2009, we had a massive collapse in the economy. And it was due to these, you know, this whole rampant market of collateralizing these mortgages. Many of them really were given to people who had no business taking these mortgages. And then the ratings industry said, oh, these are A+. And they were sold all over the world. And then when all the people could not pay these crazy mortgages, and there was these failures, you had a massive systemic collapse. And people lost their jobs, and economies were tanked, and there was tremendous suffering in America and all over the world. How many people were convicted? How many corporations were convicted for wrongdoing?
Zero?
Yeah, pretty much close to zero. Yeah, a few people here and there, but it was just a small amount. Many of the large corporations paid fines, billions of dollars, and they were able to say, we're not admitting any guilt. Right? I love that one. I'm paying you $50 billion, but I'm not accepting any guilt. I'm not saying that we did any wrongdoing. You know what I'm saying? We'll pay the fine. We want you to go away. It's really part of the part of doing business. You know what I mean? We'll pay your SEC fine for our violations. So, the bottom line is, if you're a corporation, and you have lots of money, and you have, you know, an army of genius lawyers, by and large, you're going to get away with a lot. Not everything, not all the time, but you're, in our society, you get the feeling that if you have money, you can what they call buy justice. So that alone, having laws, you can't legislate yourself into what they call legislate yourself into perfection. So, really, this is where we get to our main point of the night. Really, the main way that a person develops into a more just person has to start at young age, an education. And part of, you know, when a person becomes a Baal Tshuva or Bala Tshuva, oftentimes the focus becomes nearly entirely like, am I traveling on Shabbos? Am I not traveling on Shabbos? Am I eating this in this restaurant or am I not eating in this restaurant? You know, am I dating these kind of people or am I not dating that? Now, those are all important questions and all important decisions. But that's not the totality of Judaism. For example, let me give you a simple example, and I did this in our senior fellowship class the past year. For example, raising a dog. does having a dog bring up any issues of justice? What do you say?
Do you say having a dog?
Having a dog as a pet. Does that bring any issues of justice at all? Any questions to be considered about? What would you say?
Just the laws in your building.
Right, so there's a... Okay, laws in your
justice.
Building. Right, if your building allows to have pets, that's one. What other issues of issue? Where would issues of justice come in with having a dog?
There are social norms to follow or social requirements to follow. Cleaning up after your dog, where you can walk your dog.
100%. There's the Gamora has the following story. There was this dog that was barking at this pregnant woman, and the woman cried out. And the guy says, "What are you making complaints about?" He's such an old dog, he simply has no teeth. And the woman said, "Yes, but I just miscarried." So there's an obligation. There's oftentimes when you're a pet lover, you have this sense that my pet is awesome and I don't have to be so concerned. And people who don't appreciate my dog, well, they're really the problem. They don't have the right appreciation. They're really wussies. So invariably, I showed a video of a park in San Francisco where basically they had a big sign of all the dog rules. It has to be on a leash. They had a separate dog run, but you had to have the dog on a leash. And you had to clean up. And basically the guy had the local news basically videoed how every single one of these laws were openly and flagrantly being ignored. And they caught on tape of one of this like big Doberman pincher who was not on a leash, went up to the playground with his little girl and went up to the thing, and the girl was like completely petrified. Now, halakhically, you're not allowed. There's a law, there's a whole host of, what they call mishpatim, laws between man and man, where you have a responsibility not to simply not consciously do damage, but I have to take a high level of concern about my dog. That's one example. How about the issue of parking spaces? Is there any issue of justice by parking spaces, paying for parking and the like? What would you say about that? You want to go into the store for 5 minutes, you pull into the park, there's a parking spot right there, you want to run in and grab a quick Coke. Is there an issue?
It's probably handicapped.
Well, let's say it's not handicapped, but there's a meter there.
Oh.
And you don't put anything in the meter. Is that a problem?
That's theft.
Okay, so it depends how you define that. So if you want to define that meter really, that is really a rental of the space, so even if you use it for 5 minutes to get a Coke, and even though you don't get caught by the police, the meter maid, it could be a problem of theft against the town. You know what I'm saying? So we're going through the parshiyot of the year, I'm going to try to create a little focus on the mishpat dimension, to bring out these mishpatim things to sort of deepen our sensitivity. Many people believe, like, there's a book that everything I need to know about life I learned in kindergarten. Now, there's a part of it is true, sharing, not taking that which is others. That intuition is good, but what the mitzvot and Jewish law in general makes a person refine that entire sensitivity. Classic situation. You hire a painter to paint your apartment. They do a crummy job. Okay? You're not happy with the job. Do you pay him anything? Do you pay him half? Do you pay him for his paint? What do? So each person has a sense in their mind what they think is fair. One person will say, well, no, I don't pay him anything because I asked him for this job. He did a terrible job. One person would say, well, all right, I'll split it with the guy, whatever. So, or whatever, or I'll hire somebody else, and, you know, I'm only going to pay him if it's a difference. I'll pay him a little bit, whatever. People have 42 possible resolutions to that. Now, actually, Jewish law has a very definitive comment on how to do these problems. So there's the issue of Beit Adam L'Chaveru, a sense of justice which has to be nourished. Judaism has a lot to say about. Now, just like sometimes people might find the laws of Shabbat confusing, like, oh, is this muksa, that muksa? But also how one works with employees and co-workers and contracts and my due diligence about my car and my pets and all my property and all these different things to develop a sense of justice and being act in a righteous manner. And going back to the thing is, I don't think this is really, this is not a priority enough in the Orthodox community. And Judaism is oftentimes, what is being Orthodox? Becoming ritually Orthodox. I'm saying that's great, but there's another half of the Ten Commandments that talk about the Bein Adam L'Chaveru, and it's not just not speaking Lashon Hara about them, which is the problem. But I'm just saying that there's many things of a sensitivity toward our relationship to other people that has to be matured, refined. Just to give you, if you guys on your own time, I'm going to end with this. There's a website called the Business Halacha Institute. They have a website, and they are a series of Jewish judges, and they're given cases of very common case law, things that happen all the time, and very common 2015 types of cases, and they put it under the spectrum of what does Jewish law say about that. And if you take a look at some of those cases, I think you're going to be surprised, because I think sometimes you would guess and think you'll get it right. Sometimes you get it kind of right. And sometimes you're going to be, wow, I would have not known that. So part of our way of transitioning from a situation where we have, in our own community, where there still unfortunately is corruption, lack of injustice, and not a focus upon that, what I want to dedicate a little part, we go through the parshiot, we're going to, wherever possible, bring in the issue of mishpat, of justice. So we can, as our own community, the MG community, we can grow not just in our mitzvot between Hashem and ourselves, but the mitzvot between ourselves and our fellow man, both Jew and non-Jew alike. And which, of course, is the vital to start a stronger and more vibrant and more just Jewish people. Which, as you saw from the list down below on the sheet, we could use a little help. So that's basically it. So to summarize, if you're at a Dvar Torah, if you says, hey, somebody, Kat, Jennifer, Stacy, you got a Dvar Torah? I said, absolutely. You'll ask them, well, why was the generation of the flood condemned to death? Anybody know? Somebody might know the Rashi. Well, because they were involved in a theft. Well, were they involved in anything else? Well, Rashi brings up they were involved in idolatry and immorality. So but what's worse? If somebody's confronted with, by gunpoint, what should I do? Should I murder somebody? Or should I, and if you don't do it, I get the bullet? Or should I rob? The answer is clearly rob. So then if robbery is therefore less bad, why was God's condemnation of the entire generation of the flood based upon robbery? So the idea that we shared was the idea that there are worse things than robbery on the individual basis. But for society, in order for society to function, there has to be a working together. If every man to himself, if everybody's house is their own castle with a moat and a gun and worried that his neighbor is going to steal something, which unfortunately in certain parts of America, in some of the ghettos of America, unfortunately that is true, you think that every neighbor is going to steal from you, it breaks down the fabric of society. There could be no growth, there could be no development, there could be no future. And that's why God, as it were, saved the people who are righteous, Noah and his family, and then had to start afresh with a new generation after the flood. So that's just one idea. And we discussed a number of other ideas sprinkled in there, but there's your there's your 2.5 minute Dvartara you got in your back pocket. You can look at some of the material. There's some other Dvartara as well. So we're going to do this, by the way, a couple of points. We're going to have this every Tuesday night, the exact same Zoom address. And I want to wish everybody in advance a Shabbat Shalom and a, you know, it's great to have everybody from all the different fellowship years coming together to learn. And really a joy.
This is great. Thank you.
All the very
Thank
best.
Thank you.
Guys. Take care, guys. Have a great week.
Thank you, Anthony.
All the best. Bye.
Bye. Bye. Good night, everyone. Bye. Thank you.